Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social, or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals, and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Hello, Felicity. How have your latest travels been?
Great. I had the privilege of spending a few days in Porto in Portugal, where I ate some of the best fish in the world. But it looks like you're looking very businesslike, Luli. So has something happened?
Well, whilst you've been on the road again, we have not, unexpectedly, I should say, had rather a lot of feedback about our last episode on storytelling. Now, whilst we had lots of lovely feedback, we also had feedback from people who didn't agree with our views, Felicity.
Conflict, the essence of storytelling right there.
It is indeed. So, with your editor's hat on, can you give us a quick summary in case our listeners haven't had the opportunity to catch that episode yet?
Okay. So, we did our last episode on storytelling, and the idea was, when storytelling is done well, this is my argument, it can be a powerful tool for forging memories. But if you need it to function effectively, it needs stakes and structure. But what we agreed is there's an overemphasis on storytelling in the wine industry because it can be an excuse not to develop more effective brand marketing strategies.
Yeah, so as I said, we had, shall we say, lots of strong feedback on both sides. So listeners vehemently agreeing with you that storytelling, when done well, is essential for brand growth.
Yeah, and many listeners agreed with you that positioning awareness and distinctive brand assets are more important.
Yeah, so given the amount of feedback we had, in this episode, we are going to spend the first part revisiting storytelling, but with a new twist, and then cover a big new story in the world of RTD. So we've got a two-parter today, Felicity.
That's right. And the reason we're doing this is because Luli found this fantastic example of storytelling for us to talk about, which would have been great for our episode, but better late than never. Okay, so a full-page storytelling ad came out in the Times of London from the Sunday Times Wine Club, and we thought it was the perfect example that we could use to revisit the debate and illustrate our different arguments.
Exactly. Well, our points of view, Felicity, not arguments. We have points of view. Anyway, yes, so it was a full-page ad, as you said, for the Sunday Times Wine Club, which is actually operated by Direct Wines, the parent company behind Laithwaite's, for example, who are probably the largest DTC wine-specific retailer in the UK. And I guess their goal of taking out this full-page ad in the Times newspaper was to get people, consumers, to sign up for the wine club, even though there wasn't really a clear call to action in the advert itself.
Yes, but before I get into this, can I say congratulations for still getting a printed newspaper. I'm so pleased.
We do. I think, do you know what gets delivered daily? Once a Gen X, Felicity, always a Gen X. Anyway, yes.
Anyway, okay, so the Times, so I looked it up. So the Times don't list their ad fees, but when I was looking at the UK competitors, it suggests that a full page ad on the weekend might cost anywhere between £30,000 and £50,000.
That's so much money. A, that's the rack rate, so let's assume they negotiated a better rate. But anyway.
Well, it's the newspaper's own wine club, so I'm sure they gave themselves a bit of a discount. But why don't you, let's get stuck into this. Why don't you read the ad out, Luli? It'll take a bit because it's quite a long piece of copy.
It is. So, I shall start. So the headline says, "The little vineyard, our customers saved." And then in the corner, there's a black and white picture of two people in a vineyard, sort of made to look like an old stuck-on photo onto the page. And in the centre, a bottle shot of the Lubisson Languedoc Rosé. And then there's a lot of text.
Right, take a deep breath and off you go. Read us the text.
I am literally taking a deep breath. So the text says, some vineyards boast grandeur, Lubisson boasts age, altitude, and a geological personality disorder. Gosh, that's quite hard to say. So perched on the wild slopes of the Pic du Vesoul in remote Cabière, and always getting that wrong. Lubizon sits on one of France's most bewildering ancient patches of earth. The place draws geologists from all over, deep layers flipped upside down by some ancient tectonic prank. Vines grow in fractured schist, shale, shale and stones, not written to be read out loud. So only they, so old they make the dinosaurs look recent. And that matters because this strange stony chaos produces something magical. Carbier in the cradle of the Languedoc, it's the cradle of the Languedoc Rosé, the first appellation in the region, the long celebrated for wine, so pale they're scarcely pink at all, more Van Gris than Van Rosé. Okay, I've taken a breath. I've butchered some of it, but do I have to keep going?
Yes, you do. I have a lot to say about this ad, so the listeners need the full background. Can I just say, vines grown in fractured schist, shale and stones. So wine geology right here. Okay.
Trying to say that out loud is a tricky one, particularly for mispronunciation
over here. Seashells on the seashore. Okay.
Exactly. Right. Anyway, it continues. If we still have new listeners with us, it continues. Louis XIV took a glass daily. Lubizon's grapes grow on schisty slopes that drain like sieves, forcing the roots to dive deep between the flaky rocks. What you taste in the glass is not winemaking style, it's geology. Mm-hmm. Today, the luxury benchmark of this historic style is Gérard Bertrand's Clos de Temple, a magnificent showpiece. Firmly in fine wine territory, but Lubizon has its own proud story, less showmanship, perhaps, but rooted in real people with a real rescue. Okay, you have to take over. And if we have any listeners still with us.
Yes, I must say, I like the naming the competitors' wine to anchor on.
Okay. Pointing it out has been really good.
Yeah. Okay, so the ad goes on. The vineyard belonged to a member of the remarkable Cabrières cooperative, their pride and joy. But when its elderly farmer retired, there was a genuine fear the plot would be lost forever. So we made a proposal. If enough customers pledged for the next vintage, we would buy the vineyard ourselves, then lease it back to the village rent-free. Over 1,000 signed up and we bought Lubizon. Handing it straight to Lucy and Bryce Salick, the young growers next door, first in the valley to convert to full organic cultivation. Instead of collecting rent, we replant missing vines, rebuild stone terraces, replace tired barrels with new oak, and even help install solar panels. I wish they would be my landlord. Honestly, there's so many things I would like done in my flat. They can come and do any of that. Okay, anyway. And the wine, pale as dawn with hints of melon and apricot, delicate blossom with that clean, cool underlying streak of minerality. A tiny vineyard saved. A village supported, a wine with the mountain still in it. Drink it and you're part of it. Signed, Tony Lathwaite, CBE Club co-founder.
Yes, we got there. But perhaps we have definitely lost most of our listeners as a result. So the reason, I didn't know you were going to make us read the whole thing, Felicity, when I sent it to you. The reason I'm not sure. The reason I picked up on this because in the episode on storytelling we did, you taught me all about the Cinderella story arc. And I thought that's exactly what this advert is doing. It's basically telling the story of the region and a farmer retiring. So Direct Wines reach out to its customers and said, if enough pledge to buy the wine from the next vintage, Direct Wines would buy the vineyard and lease it back and save the village. Hurrah, hurrah. And that's what happened.
Yeah, it's a very muddled Cinderella story, if I might say. It's like they started with a ball telling you what everybody wears, and then at the very end they go, oh, she's just sitting in the ashes, and a prince came along. So if I'd been the creative director, I would have made them rework it.
So are you by any chance, Felicity, saying that this is an example of bad storytelling, or at least storytelling not done in the best way?
Look, I think it's both. My first thought when you sent it to me is that somebody has created this for the wrong medium. So this is very old-fashioned wine catalogue writing from about 30 years ago, where you'd have someone who has already opted into the wine club sitting there considering the next purchase so they can be persuaded by lyric poetry about geology and saving vineyards, and also because it makes them feel smart because they're reading about history.
Yeah. Speaking of somebody who knows, eh? Anyway, so they're basically saying that consumers writers have sort of got to have lots of time on their hands. Okay. But while, well, I'm sure Tony Lathwaite himself probably no longer writes the copy, this is very much kind of his famous style, how he founded the business, basically developing the craft of direct marketing or direct wine marketing and writing.
Yeah, that's right. So just to go back a step, in the early 1970s, Lathwaite became famous for writing a sort of long direct marketing letter about a single wine or producer and then sending it to people that he'd sort of pulled from the phone book. Now, this turned into a juggernaut known as Direct Wines, which influenced lots of other major directing, direct marketing wine companies, including in Australia and New Zealand. So Cellarmaster Wines there in the 1980s really sort of pinched his model and built an enormous business based on it. So he pretty much single-handedly developed narrative storytelling around wine.
Okay, so what's your problem with this then? So this should surely prove your point about storytelling, building brands, and retailer as well.
No, my problem is, so first of all, as storytelling, it's sort of ass backwards. you should drop the most important thing at the front. But it seems like an odd approach for a newspaper ad, basically. So nobody reads ads for entertainment or intellectual stimulation, right? So you have to make them stop in their tracks because otherwise they just, turn the page. Mm. So you either need a jaw-dropping story, or more importantly, maybe you need to tell them how their life is about to improve if they engage with this product.
Okay, so all this atmospheric writing you're basically saying is wasted space is your premise here.
Yeah, and it's very, very expensive wasted space. So you can do long-form storytelling very effectively in ads, but you've got to start with a bang. You've got to give people a reason to be reading it.
Yeah, so basically you're saying put the fear of losing the vineyard, which is in the story, up front. In other words, that's the lead. That's the start of the Cinderella story.
Yeah, and you've got to put a ticking time bomb under it. So you tell the story of how the vineyard was nearly lost and here's why this particular plot of land is so precious and how people had to race to save it.
So those are the stakes that you've talked about before.
Yeah, and then reveal at the end it all as well. So if I were rewriting this, I wouldn't just say that you can taste it. I'd also make it clear that by being part of the Sunday Times Wine Club, you're part of this noble enterprise that goes around saving historic plots of land. Like, I'd give you a stake in the story.
Yeah, and that's actually really compelling, isn't it? Because it's putting the kind of consumer at the centre of it rather than the organisation. So all the focus on geology, which I couldn't pronounce, and the generic tasting notes, I suppose I don't get any sense of how this fits into my life if I'm a consumer then, and what it means to be part of the club. So is it okay to say that it feels a bit more like a kind of a lecture, the way the copy's written?
Yeah, and it's a lecture disguised as lyric poetry, actually. So I think it's everything that's wrong with wine storytelling, because not only have they violated some basic storytelling principles to do with structure and narrative arc, but they've ignored some fundamental rules of advertising. So the first rule of ads is something that's called WIFM, what's in it for me? Why should somebody keep reading?
Yeah, unless the goal was to make the reader feel very literary.
Maybe
that's the way it's always, the copy's always been written that way, and they kind of don't see a reason to change back to the history of the organisation just talking about.
It's possible, and maybe, there's a comfort in, here's the Lathwaite's ad doing the way it always has. But, I would love to know what the strategic thinking was behind this. Anyway, if anybody else has got wine stories they want to send us to critique, our email is at the end of the episode.
Do you think anybody's actually going to do that? We're going to make enemies of every wine institution in the world at this rate, Felicity, and not just the famous ones like the Sunday Times Wine Club.
No, we're all purpose insult machine here, Lily. So, all right, so let's turn from
story. Don't discriminate.
Yeah, that's right. And nobody's allowed to critique our storytelling. It's off limits. All right, so let's get into the news. Luli, what have you been watching?
Okay, so the big story that I wanted to bring to this episode is what we could say looks like a sort of fairly standard bit of drinks industry news. So another RTD acquisition. Okay, but actually I think this is quite revealing if we kind of step back and dig a bit deeper into it.
Luli, you wouldn't by any remote chance be talking about Finnish Long Drink being acquired by the Canadian Mark Anthony Group, the people who were behind White Claw by any chance, were you?
Uh, By some chance, Felicity, indeed I am. It's like you knew we had planned to talk about it for this discussion.
No, as with everything we feature on this show, it's completely off the top of our head spontaneity.
I think with the amount of tangents and mispronunciations I do, nobody could accuse us of being overprepared, Felicity. Anyway, back to the Finnish long drink. So since it's sitting at the top of your head, do you want to talk about it? Do you want to give
Okay, so you have to be careful. So there are actually two Finnish long drinks. The first is a gin and grapefruit soda drink that was created for the Helsinki Olympics in 1952. It's generic. It's like calling it gin and tonic, right?
Okay, so first up, and genuinely, I didn't know that. I didn't know that it was invented for the Helsinki Olympics. So the one we're referring to here was founded in 2018 by a group that included both Finnish and American peeps. And it's a reinvention of an original concept, as you were saying. But what's really interesting is here, they trademarked the name of the Finnish long drink and created a distinct identity for it. So they've got their branding, their logo, their typeface, their colours, all of the distinctive brand assets that I love so much.
Well, you know, what this makes me wonder is, could we create a trademark drink called the Gin and Tonic?
Well, that would be spectacular. I doubt it very much. Is putting the word "the" in front of it, does that sound
well, works for them?
That you can
we could trademark the Negroni. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so this could go on a long time.
All right, so
the margarita. No,
yeah, that's
stop,
right. The margarita.
Stop,
that's
stop,
right.
Stop. So, okay, and we so could go up against your favourite little gin and tonic in a can.
Oh no, that's going too far. That's too bold. No.
Okay.
All right, let's go back to the Finnish.
Yes.
Okay.
Get
so
us back.
In 2022, Diageo took a minority stake in it that really allowed them sort of distribution and scaling, right? And it scaled pretty well. So founder-led company. I think there are some celebrity names attached, and lots of sales.
Exactly. So as you said, Mark Antony also owns White Claw, so the hard seltzer that went ballistic a few years ago, as well as Mike's Hard Lemonade. So this month in, we're recording in April 2026, they bought the Finnish long drink for an estimated $325 million.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense from a business point of view. So White Claw dominates the malt-based RTD, but the market is moving towards the spirit-based RTDs. So the Finnish long drink obviously fits that white space in their portfolio, and plus it's still in growth and it sits in a more premium area than White Claw.
Yeah, and what struck me immediately when I saw all of the sort of reporting on the deal, the announcement of the deal, was how direct the stated rationale for the purchase was. So they talked about accelerating growth, expanding distribution and scaling the brands. So there's no attempt to kind of dress this up as anything more than a commercial.
Yes, so they actually told the truth. Because normally with these announcements, you get press releases that are about shared values and brand alignment, or, you know, some sort of sense of mission and purpose and strategic fit. Whereas here it feels very pragmatic. We understand the category, we know how to scale it, and this is a brand that's already working, so we can make it significantly bigger. And the unspoken thing is, and we can cash in.
Absolutely, exactly. And there's another layer to it, I think, as well, which is that they weren't coming into this cold. So they were already distributing the long drink in Canada. So it's not a speculative acquisition. It's not, we think we might be able to make this work. It's, we have seen how this performs in the market. We understand the mechanics and we know how to see the upside, how to scale to
the
upside.
Yes, and we have $325 million down the back of the sofa. So, and of course, this shifts how you interpret the deal. So it's not about fixing or repositioning, it's just about scale. So it's about taking something that's already working and putting it into a much more powerful distribution system.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the bits that's worth dwelling on. So this is not innovation in the traditional sense. It's not about creating something new internally. It's about identifying where growth already exists and then acquiring it, which, when you say it out loud, of course, sounds pretty obvious and clearly has been done many times before. But bear with me. So for sort of stating the obvious there, the drinks industry has spent a long time doing the opposite, so kind of incubating things internally and then wondering why they might not work or indeed at best move slowly.
Yes, and this happens to be an unusually well-chosen example, Lily. I wonder why you chose it, because it's an exemplar of a much broader pattern. It's not an isolated example. So we're seeing the same logic repeated across a number of these recent RTD deals, and their consistency is striking once you line them up.
So let's do that, shall we? Shall we line them up? Maybe it might also lead to a framework. Let's do, if you're lucky.
We can't do an episode without one of your frameworks, really.
No, we can. But in all seriousness, I think if we put three or four of these recent deals side by side, we can start to see some really quite clear patterns about where the industry is heading. So some second example off the back of that one would be Sazerac Company buying Buzzballs, which we've talked about.
Now, before you continue, just on the slim chance that some of our listeners might not be familiar, do you want to explain what it is? Because it is very much an American brand at this stage.
Okay. Yeah. So they are Buzzballs. Basically, think brightly coloured sort of tennis ball shaped size spherical plastic containers. And in them are single serve pre-mixed cocktails. They've got wrinkle tops. They're 200 mils and typically a 13.5% ABV. So they're spirits-based pre-mixed cocktails in a ball-shaped container.
And they got a great big feature article recently in the New York Times all to themselves because they are the go-to drinks for underage drinkers. Now, although you look 16, I know you're not. Have you actually tried one of these, Lily?
Flattery will get you everywhere, even if this not in reality. As you know, Felicity, I take my podcast research very seriously. I do. So I went out last week and I bought two different Buzzballs, which are currently in the prime location chilled cabinet, about as close as you can get to the self-checkout in my local Tesco's.
Right. I didn't realise that they must be in the UK because I haven't seen them in Europe, but... Maybe I haven't been looking in the right cabinet. Anyway, what did you think of them?
Well, we clearly need to start from the premise that I am not, funnily enough, their target audience. But you'll be pleased to know that I bought enough to be able to test them with my in-house Gen Z correspondents.
Of course you did. And what was their verdict?
Okay, so we tried Tequila Rita, which is the green one, and Strawberry Rita.
Which, let me guess, is the red one.
It is, and you're correct. It's neon, bright red. I'm literally, we poured some into a glass just to see what the colour was. Absolutely. So, not surprisingly, for me, they are too sweet. But as I say, I am not the target audience. My in-house Gen Zers actually were already regular drinkers of them. So it's not new to them. But I did learn something new to me that I hadn't really thought about before from my in-house Gen Zers, which is there is a whole category entry point that I hadn't thought about, which Buzzballs is really capitalising on.
And I bet your kids said that. I said, Mum, do you know why we're doing this? It's because of the category entry point. Because I know they talk like that in the Halston household.
I interpreted it as category entry point. I don't want to disappoint. So they told me that Buzzballs are not only perfect for them to take to somebody's house or when people come over to their house when they're socialising, they're pre-gaming, but there was a whole occasion, which I hadn't thought about because I'm not of their generation, which is basically walking from home or wherever you've gathered to the pub or club, wherever you're going. So basically they pick up Buzzballs because they're available effectively at every convenience store here in the UK and they drink them en route. So basically it is the ultimate on the door occasion.
Isn't that completely illegal? Are you sure you want to say that on a podcast?
No, I'm in the UK here, Felicity, you can drink. So they literally get them because they said you get the buzz, as in the alcohol. It's not too much volume of liquid. It's easy to hold and drink on the go, and that's why it works for them.
Okay. All right. So Ed Mundy, the beverage analyst from Jefferies Private Bank, says that what's important about these drinks that do really well with this group is that they are under $1 a unit of alcohol.
Yeah, so basically cheap.
Yeah, basically. So, and of course, the flavours mean that they have high appeal for novice drinkers. Now, Sazerac claims in that article that they don't aim them at teenagers, but you can certainly see why they appeal to teenagers.
You can. And what's interesting, I think, also is that Sazerac, which just for the backstory, is a privately owned US spirits company, family controlled, operating in over 100 countries, doing, it depends who you listen to, but somewhere between 3 and 5 billion in revenue. So
I grew up in a family like that, a family of booze that's got 3 billion. $1 billion. Yes. I really missed out on the lottery of life.
You did. And Little is your best friend as a result.
Yes, that's
right. So they're best known for brands like Buffalo Trace, Fireball, Svedka, those kind of brands.
I don't know any of those, but I'm assuming they're all pretty high octane, judging from the names.
Yeah, actually, they're all pretty well-respected and successful spirits brands within their category, so within vodka or bourbon or, you know, the different categories. But what's interesting is that they said with this acquisition, it was focused on a rapidly growing beverage business. So they're basically buying that momentum, as we were just talking about, to scale.
Well, you don't become a billionaire by resting around and not buying things when they're hot. So
yes.
So they're very obviously very got a good eye for growth, and this is about a format that's clearly working.
Yeah, and I think that matters, because it's not about adding another brand to their portfolio for the sake of it. It's about bringing in something that is already demonstrating velocity, as we were talking about. But Buzzballs has been doing exactly that. It's one of those brands that kind of spirits establishment sort of largely ignored for many years and then suddenly looked up and found out it was actually generating serious volume.
Right. Do you want to know about where it came from, which is quite an interesting story?
Okay, take us into History Corner then.
Well, Buzzballs was founded, get this, by a former school teacher. Her name was Marilee Kick. She founded it in Texas in 2009 as part of her MBA project. So it says in the newspaper that she'd spotted a gap for portable single-serve cocktails that didn't rely on bar prep. And you wonder how much her background as a teacher allowed her to spot that opportunity. So she wanted something that could work in real-world occasions like events and convenience retail. So she built it into a national brand, and she stayed owner until it was acquired by Sazerac in 2024. And she got an estimated about $500 million. So she walked off with something like $400 million maybe, which is extraordinary considering that she bootstrapped the whole thing.
Yeah, and can I just add that being a female founder in drinks is still frustratingly rare. Actually, what's quite interesting when I was looking at the containers of Buzzballs is Sazerac have kept that story very visible. So the packaging still says women founded on the packaging. Yeah,
interesting. So they're clearly not trying to take a piece of the traditional premium spirits market. No. It's very clearly positioned around convenience, fun, certain types of occasions where you can walk down the street with them, I guess. So yes. What Sazerac is buying is not just a brand or a product, it's access to those occasions.
Exactly. So you have very nicely taken us into the world of occasions. Category entry points again, Felicity. Thank you. Which I think is a pretty significant thing to buy, because sort of occasions don't respond particularly well to being launched at. You really have to earn them, or you require a brand that is already doing that.
All right. So this is the moment to bring in AB InBev's acquisition of 85% of Beatbox, which is something we've also talked about in a previous roundup episode. So you can go and listen to that.
Yeah, we did. And you see a similar logic, but expressed slightly differently this time. So there the framing is around kind of beyond beer, because it's AB InBev that purchased it, which is a phrase we've been hearing for a while now, but I think it's becoming increasingly literal.
Yes, and for a very pragmatic reason. So beer is not delivering the growth it once did. So all of these companies are looking for adjacent categories that can. And it's worth noting that AB InBev is not a romantic drinks company. They're very focused on bottom line. They're very disciplined about what they do.
Yeah, so thinking about the acquisition of Beatbox, it's interesting in that the context is clearly built for a sort of different set of occasions, again, sort of extending the occasions for beer. So yes, there is beer at festivals, parties, high energy environments, but this is where portability and ease matter more than anything else. So again, what's being acquired here is not just the liquid or even a brand, it's a way of participating in occasions that are either growing or at least holding up better than the more traditional beverage occasions.
Yes, and this is clearly where RTDs have an important structural advantage. So they're able to be drunk the way people actually drink in those contexts. You don't have to prepare them, they don't require knowledge, and they fit very neatly into environments where convenience is critical, meaning you can stick one in your pocket at a festival so you don't have to buy the drinks. So you can't carry a bottle of Burgundy in the same way. I mean, well, you could try, but it's not going to work.
Are you speaking from personal experience there, trying to sneak a bottle of Burgundy
but this is a really important point. When we've finished with the RTDs, remind me to tell you about the new convenience market that's popping up.
Okay. Can't wait for that one. Okay, so final example of an RTD acquisition in the pattern that we were talking about, which is potentially the most revealing of them all. So Molson Coors acquired Atomic Brands actually just a few weeks ago in March 2026, with the main brand being Monaco Cocktails.
I actually don't know Monaco Cocktails. Do you want to explain?
Okay, so this brand is a high-strength canned spirits-based cocktail again, but there is a difference here. They're typically 9% ABV and positioned, and is in their comms as effectively what they call double strength.
Oh, well, right. So there's a drink for everybody, isn't there?
There is, Felicity. So Molson Coors talks specifically in the deal announcement about this giving them feet on the street that matter.
Oh, well, actually, this is a really good point. So I take it what they mean is they've got a good sales team. And this is actually really important. So I've been talking to colleagues from California about the sort of the collapse of the distribution model over there. And one of the things that they tell me is that with some of the big distributors, they cut their sales teams. And this turned out to have grave consequences for sales, as you might predict.
Exactly. And there's a significant shift in how we think about these deals, because traditionally acquisitions are framed as buying brands, buying the brand equity, buying the brand recognition. But here it's much more explicit that they are also buying capability as well, i.e. the sales force that already knows how to open doors in the channels where RTDs actually sell.
Yes, and this is important because you've got to have specialist knowledge about how to sell these different packs. It's probably easier to get a specialist sales team than to try and retrain beer experts, I guess.
Yeah. And when you put it alongside the other acquisitions we've been talking about, so the Finnish Long Drink, Buzzball and Beatbox, it becomes quite clear what's going on. So these companies are not trying to build their way into RTDs from scratch. They are clearly identifying the brands that have already solved the key problem. So the product market fit, the occasion relevance, initial distribution, and then using their scale basically to amplify those.
Yeah, I guess on the one hand, you could say this is a very sort of efficient allocation of capital. It is, you know, I guess it, what it also means is the big companies have basically given up on innovating. They're letting other people do it and then, you know, waiting to see if it fails or not and getting the results. I suppose that's a good thing. But, you know, you also wonder, should big companies be innovating, or is this a better model? I don't know.
Well, I suppose what this does is about minimising the riskiest part, isn't it? So getting someone to do the work in the first place. And someone else has already spent the money on the failed flavors or the failed products and the underperforming launches. And so they're mitigating against distribution that hadn't worked either. So they're, you know, all those issues and problems have been on somebody else's watch.
Now I'm thinking out loud again. Over the years, I have seen big companies try to innovate, and often they do it really badly because, you know, they have so many layers of processes to go through. And once a creative idea has hit six different committees, it just gets, you know, flattened into something really boring. So basically what all of this is doing is it's taking the risk away from it, which is very important in this very high risk environment we're in at the moment.
Yeah, and I think it's the sort of back to the innovation in big companies. It often ends up being kind of what we call innovation by committee, which then sort of neutralizes it down to, you know, then losing its purpose or its edge, which often, you know, sort of founders themselves are typically and inherently by their nature more entrepreneurial and more risk taking from that point of view. So, you know, it goes that way.
Having been around enough big companies, it's usually what happens, especially if they have history, is you suggest something, they go, no, we tried that years ago. Yeah, well, maybe the timing was right, or maybe the execution was wrong. You know,
tried it, didn't work. So I think this sort of discussion on these recent RTD acquisitions leads us to a bigger question, which is why is this happening now and why is it happening in RTD specifically? Because if you look at the broader alcohol market, the context is quite challenging. As we know, volumes are under pressure across most categories, value growth is uneven at best, and a lot of traditional formats are not performing particularly strongly.
Whereas everybody loves the RTDs, they keep growing and growing.
What they do, so IWSR data puts the global RTD category at over 40 billion litres in consumption, and it's been one of the few parts of the alcohol beverage market that's grown consistently, both in volume and value, over the past 5 years. Although I should add, not at the rates we saw in sort of 2019, 2021. Mm. Those growth rates have slowed, but they are still growth in a category, total category, where we're often not seeing that.
Yeah, look, I'm certain, based on just my gut instinct, but I'm pretty certain the cost of living crisis is behind this. These drinks are just better value than most other categories.
Yeah, well, the part of it, isn't it, is that the sticker price, because they're smaller formats, is therefore lower than buying a larger 70-centilitre spirit, 750ml wine, whatever it is. And maybe they're more relevant too, because RTDs are designed to fit into more modern drinking occasions in a way that traditional formats struggle to. And I think a lot of it is about portability, ease of consumption, and they don't require much effort or knowledge on the part of the consumer.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's the fact that they're single serve that makes them attractive, but also you don't have to, you know, scrabble around trying to find the corkscrew.
Yeah. And you can, if we compare it to having to invest in a 750ml bottle of wine, where you have to find it, you know, find the way of opening it or serving it, chilling it, etc.
So we would call that friction. It introduces friction.
Yeah, exactly. And when you're competing in a lower attention convenience driven environment, friction really, really matters. So it matters enormously. So the Oxford Handbook of Behavioural Economics has a phrase for this, and they call it effort tax. Oh. So every step a consumer has to take is a small tax on the decision. And RTDs almost have no effort tax, whereas wine in many contexts actually has a really high effort tax.
Yeah, and also there's no nice way to say this, but it's getting increasingly difficult to find interesting or higher quality wines at these lower price points, particularly in markets like the UK, which is partly because of the way the tax has been configured. Yeah. But you have to spend more and more and more to get decent quality, and that means you're taking a big risk when you buy a bottle.
Yeah, and that takes us back to the acquisitions we've been talking about, because what these companies are saying is that this is where the demand is and this is where they can grow.
Yeah, it also tells you something about how conservative the market is becoming. So the days of taking a gamble on something are pretty much over.
Yeah, and I think the final point I'd make on this is that these brands being acquired are not interchangeable. So they tend to have something quite specific, whether it's a distinctive format, a very clear occasion or route to market, or a very strong identity that really sets them apart from the mass category.
And of course, they can be scaled.
Yeah, and I think it really signals where the industry believes growth is coming from. Right. You wanted me to remind you a story about convenience.
Oh, yes. Thank you for reminding me. Okay, so we've been talking about the fact that the RTDs are doing well because they're both cheap and portable. Yeah. And that despite the protestations of the companies involved, they have a clear appeal, let's say, across age groups, but they include younger drinkers.
And they might appeal to older drinkers sometimes too.
Absolutely. They do appeal to older drinkers, and I have proof. So the Wall Street Journal recently ran an article called "Drinks Are So Expensive That Grown-Ups Are Pre-Gaming Like They Did in College."
I love that. So that's the Anglo phrase for getting your drinks in before you go out for the night.
Yeah, that's right, pre-gaming. Correct. Though I've got friends in the UK who tell me their kids call it pre-loading.
Yes. So you should set the scene and tell everyone just how expensive it is to drink in the US for our non-US-based listeners.
Oh, it's gut-wrenching. So a glass of really average wine at any sort of restaurant is between about $18 and $20. And according to this article, the average price of a cocktail is $13.61.
Not where I've been in the US, certainly not in Manhattan. In fact, in a lot of other places as well. So I bought cocktails that are much closer to like $30, $35.
Yeah, I was really surprised at that. And in fact, so were the comments underneath going, $13.61, where are you going shopping for your cocktails? And in the article, it actually quotes somebody who was going to the theatre who said buying a vodka and soda would be $36 at the interval.
That's breathtaking, isn't it? So it makes sense to kind of come round and have a few glasses of something then before you go out.
Yeah, well, apparently there are whole Reddit forums telling you how to go about slipping something into your backpack or handbag and not get caught. So big brands have realised this, and they're getting in on it by selling airline-sized bottles to consumers.
So I've seen these. So Diageo, for example, puts the premium Don Julio 1942 tequila into the sort of 50ml containers.
Yes, and a lot of brands are doing this. So you need a new social skill to navigate this. The trick is to learn how to get buzzed enough to feel it, but not enough that they're going to keep you out of the venue.
Okay, and what do people drink when they go out then?
Water or the cheapest non-alcoholic drink they can get away with.
Okay. So I guess it's bringing back the kind of Mad Men era of cocktail hour. Maybe we're returning back to that, where people would gather for a glass of something before going out.
Yeah. So I first heard about this at Wine Paris back in February when, so many of the stands, particularly from the Americans, had all these 200ml Tetra Paks everywhere with the resealable screw top lids. Anyway, the Californians told me that they were selling them. They were going gangbusters because they were selling them to parents who were taking them to school places. And baseball matches where they were stuck for hours.
Oh, so they'd
pull this out of their backpack, stick it in the Coke cup, and manage to get through the rest of the thing.
I can think of many a school concert where that would have been quite handy.
Do you know, I remember my aunt telling me, she said the great thing about kids growing up and moving away from home is you don't have to go to any more primary school plays.
Okay, so it's not an occasion that perhaps most of us admit to.
No, that's right. But the reason they're not taking cans, which you'd think would be the obvious solution, is that once you've opened a can, it's open, whereas with a Tetra Pak, you can just reseal it and put it back.
So why go to all the trouble? You know, you just get in, just fill a water bottle.
Well, that's what my friends in San Francisco told me. So I was telling them about the Tetra Pak, and they said their wine people said they would never buy a cheap Tetra Pak of wine. And then they pulled off their shelf their special vitamin water bottles. So the one with the green stripe is for white wine, and the one with the dark stripe is for red wine.
That's hilarious. So I completely approve of their recycling. And so they're taking these bottles in with them. And effectively, they've got white wine in them.
Yeah, that's right. Good white wine. Yes, that's right. So have you ever pre-gamed, Lulie?
Well, I suppose yes. So if it's having drinks before you go out to a restaurant or an event, then yeah, of course. So it's kind of like cocktail hour around at somebody's house is coming back into fashion. So good things. It's a good job that I didn't clear out all of the bottles from my drinks cabinet after our episode about leftover bottles. But you're sticking to your little gin and tonic?
No, I've branched out. So there's a more upmarket supermarket, equidistant from Lidl. It's called Raver. And they sell bottles of pre-mixed Negronis, which are actually really great. So they're properly bitter and everything. It's like, €9.
And
you can get about 10 cocktails in them. So that's my go-to at the moment.
So see, you're pre-gaming with R2D spirits-based cocktails. It's only taken you like a year to change your drinks habits.
That's right.
So to sum up the episode, Felicity, what have we learned today other than it takes you a very long time to switch drinks?
I'm loyal, Lulie. I'm just a loyal person. Okay, so what we've learned is that storytelling, as I said previously, can be really powerful. If it's done properly, it has to start with a story that's going to do something for the customer, not the brand and not the overly long and complicated lecture.
Yep. And we've learned that the biggest acquisitions in the drinks industry are currently RTDs, and not just because that's where the market is coming from, but also because RTDs start with occasions, Felicity, rather than product. So completing... that's completely the other way around from most wine businesses do it, where they're product-led and not even thinking about occasions.
Now, we, on the other hand, are completely listener-led, which means we really appreciate all the emails and messages we get. So if you have any questions or suggestions, send them along to aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
I saw what you did there, Felicity. Very clever. And I will read the emails as always.
Because Lulie is not just an adventurous drinker, she's also very reliable.
I am. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send us any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.